Good morning. We're the Lansing Fisher Body Historical Team. It is April 28th, 2006. The time is 9 a.m., and we are at the local 602 Frank Dreyer Greenhouse. First, we're going to introduce the team.
John Fedor.
Jerry Smith.
Cheryl McQuaid.
And I'm Doug Rademacher. Today, we are going to interview Jody Don Frazier. Jody, would you please state your name and spell it?
Jody Don Frazier, J-O-D-Y-D-O-N, Frazier, F-R-A-S-H-E-R.
And what is your address?
My address is 6191 Krause Road, Ovid, Michigan, 48866.
Are you married?
Yes, I am.
And do you have any children?
Yes, I have two.
Jody, where were you born and raised?
I was born in Escanaba, Michigan.
What about Escanaba? Why don't you tell us a little bit about where you were raised?
Escanaba is a small, basically a little retirement town. It's on Little Bay de Nock. Actually, it's 180 miles west past the bridge. It's a beautiful little community.
You said the bridge. Which bridge is that? And where is this Escanaba in reference to the Lansing Fisher Body?
It would be approximately 490 miles, and I was referring to the Mackinac Bridge. We call it the UP. I am a Uper, eh? But it is a beautiful little community. I was blessed to be raised in. So,
okay. What is your education level?
I graduated from Escanaba Area High School. Upon graduation, I came down 2.5 months after I graduated and found a job at Fisher Body. And then I went to Lansing Community College for approximately 1 year.
Okay, let's go back up. Do you have any military?
Never been in the military.
What did your parents do for a living?
My father was worked for the Escanaba Area Schools. He was a maintenance man, and then he eventually came. He was the maintenance supervisor. He was responsible for all the outlying schools and the schools in town, making sure the buses got there, keep them running, all the grounds and all the mechanical things in the school. And my mother worked at the West End Drugstore. Actually, she worked there for 22 years, 7 days a week, on a split shift.
Would you tell me, Escanaba, you said it was a retirement community. What else went on in that town, and what did you do up there before you retired into Fisher Body?
Well, actually, my grandfather took me on when I was approximately 11 years old. He cleaned a banquet hall. It was also Teamsters Local 328 of Escanaba, but they rented out the halls. And I was a janitor. I was a janitor from 11 years old until I was 18 years old.
Just out of curiosity, can you tell us what was the Teamsters needed for up there?
The Teamsters took care of most of the grocery stores up there. They did have some trucking companies. We had P&H cranes were built in Escanaba, Michigan. That would be harness figure cranes, mobile cranes, and also over-the-head cranes. I was anticipating going to work at Harness Figure. That was one of the largest employers in Escanaba. But at that time, the city fathers had given them the land with tax abatements, and they were doing so well that they believed that they should tax Harness Figure. And they said, if you tax us, we will move. And the city fathers did not believe that. They imposed the taxes on the property, and it was approximately 3 months later, they took 450 people out, laid them off, left a boom crew of 50, And they were there approximately 6 months later, they completely shut the manufacturing down of the P&H Omega crane. Escanaba was also known for the largest mobile crane in the world was built in Escanaba, Michigan. So that was one employment opportunity that went away. The only other large employer in Escanaba was Mead Paper. Mead Paper Company at that time was pretty family-oriented. If you didn't know somebody in the business, you pretty much didn't get hired. So what I meant by a retirement community, if you didn't own a business, work for the schools, or work for Mead Paper, basically there was not much to do in Escanaba. They relied on tourism, and basically it was an older crowd in the city.
Okay. You started to go there on this question here. Why did you hire into Fisher Body?
Well, that just goes off what I was talking about. Basically, there was no employment. And at that time, my parents wanted me to go to college. But basically what I had in my mind, I wanted to make my own way. I wanted some type of money coming in. I was making $2.50 an hour working as a janitor. And that really didn't keep a whole lot of things going at $60 a week, $60 to $80 a week. So that's when my brother graduated from Ferris State University as he had an automotive degree, and he had job applications Lansing, Detroit, and all the surrounding areas. And he ended up getting hired here in Lansing, Michigan at Plant 4. At that time it was called the Reliability Garage. So I came down to help him move from Ferris to here. And at that time, they were hiring at the chassis plant, Local 652. We had talked to some people in town, and they said, I have an application. All you've got to do is stand in line. So I called the taxi cab. I filled out the application. I went over there. There was approximately 25,000 people in line. I was standing in line. The line was well over a half a mile long, 6 to 8 people wide. And I stood out there approximately a day and a half. And through the evening, I had been standing on my feet so long, I got to the point in the line where we kind of had a little ledge on a building. And I sat down, and I ended up falling asleep. And I gotta believe there was 5,000 to 8,000 people walked by me because I fell asleep. And by the time I got up to get my application in, they had two boxes. They had a box on top, and they had a box underneath the table. And my application went to the one on the bottom. So I was pretty disappointed. But there was somebody in line that said that other plant across town is hiring. And at that time, my brother, I was left here. My brother had to go back to Big Rapids to retrieve some more things. And basically, it was a wonderful thing because it was my birthday. That would have been my 19th birthday was coming up. And they said, that other plant on the other side of town, it's called Fisher Body, is hiring. Same program. You just got to go get in line. But I didn't have an application. So I thought, well, I don't know anybody here. I might as well go stand in line. So I called a taxi cab, gave them the name, and they took me over to Fisher Body. That was approximately at 8 o'clock in the morning. I stood there from 8 o'clock in the morning to the following morning on the third stair. And I stood there. And again, that was another line that went all the way down the front of Verlinden, back around the corner into the north parking lot, all the way down the side of the north parking lot, Then it circled back around on the inside of the parking lot, all the way to the exit out of the parking lot. But I was on the third stair, so I thought, I'm in. Okay. At that time, they announced, okay, everybody needs to back up. And we are going to open the doors for an interview. Because at that time, you'd go right into the plant to get interviewed. And as they announced that, again, I was on the third stair. They didn't have the dugout, a cover over the dugout at that time. And as soon as they announced that they were going to open the doors, people started jumping down in the dugout. I was on the third stair now. By the time I got in, I was number 36th in line. They jumped over and they pushed and shoved and slugged people up the stairs because they wanted to get in first to get hired. Well, I was 18 years old. I was from out of town. I was scared to death. I just got literally beaten up the stairs. I got into the building, and my father sent me down here with a big pair of work boots, a hard hat, and gloves. And I stood in line with all this. I walked in. A gentleman named Jerry Brooks said, I'll take him. We went back into a little room, and he asked me, son, what are you doing here? I said, well, I've come from Escanaba, Michigan, and I'm looking for a job. And he says, you come from government beef and turnips, don't you? And I really didn't understand what he meant at the time, but after 29 years seniority, I kind of understand what he meant with government beef and turnips. It was the venison, okay? You go shoot your own meat up in the UP. And I just said, yes, sir. And he asked me a question. He says, what are you going to do today if I don't hire you? I said, well, sir, to tell you the truth, I'm going to call a cab, and I'm going to have them take me to 27 North, and I'm going to hitchhike home to Escanaba, which would be approximately 7.5 hour drive. I'm going to hitchhike home, and I'm going to have a drink in my hometown bar called the Granada. And he goes, happy birthday, son. He says, there's only one issue here today. He says, I don't believe you UP boys have a high school up there, and I need to see a diploma. I said, sir, I have one. He says, you produce a diploma. And he says, I'm sending you down to the hospital to get a physical today. You show me that diploma, and you're going to go to work. This was on a Tuesday. I could not get my diploma down here until Thursday. I brought it in, and I went to work building headliners on that Friday. I went in on a Friday on the night shift, and they told me, they took me upstairs to a little room. I was the very last person that they chose, and they took me downstairs to build up headliners. And it was pretty scary, coming into a big new facility, because where I come from, we had basically one stoplight. There was no such thing as an exit. It was pretty overwhelming. There wasn't many minorities in the UP, and we had all these different people in the plant. It was a wonderful experience. I had great people when I first hired in. But I think my wage in September 16th of 1977 was $6.68 an hour. And my first day, I made $68 in one day. And that's what I used to make in a week in high school. So life was good. I had a new job. I called home. I said, I got a job. I've got to come home and get my stuff. So I came home, and my mother was standing there. She goes, you don't have to take anything. I said, Mom, I asked you to get my stuff together. And she goes, no. She says, you can't go. You can't go down and have a job. And I said, Mom, she says, you're going to college. You cannot leave me here with the dog and your father all by myself. She says, you're staying home. And I said, Mom, I got a job. And my car was broke at that time, so my father had the car, his car, packed, sitting out in front of the house, and said, you got to go to work. And it was quite a thing to leave home. It was, 3 days after my 19th birthday. I went home, got my stuff, got my father's car. He said, you will pay me when you get the money. But he said, go. And I got to believe that was one of the hardest things I ever did in my life when I left home. I definitely had a little tear in my eye. You know, my mom's crying, and here I'm going, and I got to go. You know, and I came down here, and that started my career here at Lansing Fisher Body.
Well, you've done real well. I want to round some of this out now. So you are... one of how many siblings? How many?
I have two older brothers, Patrick and Michael. My oldest brother is, 9 years older than I am. My brother Pat is in the middle. I think there is 4 years between us, and I'm the baby of the family.
That kind of rounds out Mom's story. Mom says you're staying home, and Dad says you're off to work. You said you got your diploma. Was that obviously mailed because we didn't have
yes.
other technologies and stuff back then? Can you tell me? You said you took it in and showed it. Now you stood in line for days to get an application in. How once you got your diploma, you were able to just walk right in and
I didn't
know who to ask for. How did you do that?
I'd already taken my physical, and my only responsibility at that time for employment was to prove that I had a high school education. So I was hired if I produced the diploma.
So you said you got that on a Thursday. Did you go in Thursday and show your diploma?
Yes. And
they said report tomorrow?
Tomorrow.
Now, tell us about that. Now you've been in the door. You hadn't seen the assembly line yet.
No.
And you've seen offices and people that wear ties and so forth, but can you tell us now, you come to work that first day, did you have your work boots on and that hard hat, or what did they call it?
Well, they, I hate to say it, but they were kind of laughing at me. They were laughing at me like a young kid, a hick, coming down from the UP looking for a job, but I didn't understand what my responsibility would be. As a young man, I thought construction, you're working, you know, safety, you have to have, you know, PPE. You got to have a hard hat, personal protective equipment, you got to have gloves on, big boots, steel-toed boots so you can't hurt your feet, and you know, everybody's in there in shorts and, you know, tank tops, and here I come loaded for bear. You know, it was different.
Share your first day. You've come in. You said you were the last one out. Tell us about what it was like. You came in, you hired in with a group of people?
There was approximately, don't quote me on the number, but I think about 10 or 12 people. We were in the offices by labor relations. A handful of supervisors came down. They said, this group comes with me. We went into the plant, up some stairs, and we went over, and they called it the trim office. And they put us in this little room. They had chairs all the way around. We sat down. Supervisors would come in and basically, with my knowledge, now they were sizing us up. You know, he's a big boy. I'll take him. He looks like he's a good worker. I'll take him or her, whatever the case was. Well, I was about 128 pounds right out of high school. And I guess I kind of look like a runt, you know what I mean, and the goofball with the boots and the hat, and, you know. So, two gentlemen came up, I don't remember their first, Maury and Steiner, and they were the headliner group. And I said, I guess you're mine, son, come with me. So we went into the automotive setting where the line was, and all of a sudden they said, no, come this way. So we went back downstairs. There was nobody down there except stock, and we had four people. I think I was working with Wayne Stein, Helen Telling, I don't remember the repairman's name, Daryl Mangles. He was a repairman on the other side of us. And I go down there, there was no cars. I said, well, what do you got to do to get up there? It was fascinating. As I walked into that building, I just had the wow syndrome. You know, I mean, look at this place. And logistics were an issue. I was getting lost. I didn't know where to go. And they said, go to the cafeteria. The cafeteria took me 45 minutes to get there, and I got lost coming back, and no one would really tell me where to go. I'd tell them headliners, say, go down there. So I'd go down there, I'd take another turn. I was lost. I was lost in the building. But I, knowing what I know today, that was a premium job. That was a great job. It was an off-the-line job I hired on. And we worked into, I think it was September, October, November. It was coming into December, and we were getting tight in 1977, and they were anticipating a new model. We had a model change from the large Cutlass going down to the small Cutlass. And they said, we have a new job out there. It's called T-tops and sunroofs. We've never did this in a production setting. And they went around to all the people, and no one wanted the job. So I said, I'll do it. I'll take it. And it wound up to be a great job. People were very jealous after they found out what this job was. Because we did 16 jobs a night when everybody else did 600. We were working 6 days a week, 9 hours a day. The production line never ever stopped. If you stopped that line, we had the general supervisors would come down on their little carts screaming, why is the line down? This line should not be down. But fascinating, it was... I gotta believe, probably the best thing that ever could have happened to me at the time. I didn't realize how important college was back then. I was a young kid. The money started coming in. I had an opportunity to buy a brand new 1977 Cutlass Brougham. I had my own apartment at 19 years old. I had a brand new car at 19 years old. I had money in my pockets. It was a wonderful opportunity. The people around me, once I got in there and got my 90 days in, it was great. It was fun to go to work, the camaraderie. I was young. I was fairly handy. It was good for me.
I want to round up some of your story here, Jody. Tell me, you just mentioned this 90 days. What did 90 days mean to anybody?
Well, at that time, 90 days had to be put in before you could possibly join the union and be a permanent employee. Basically, it's a trial period. If you did not cut the mustard, management had the right to discharge you without any explanation. So if you couldn't do your job, or you were a slacker or a troublemaker or something like that, before your 90 days, they would probably discharge you. So work hard. Yes, it was something I wanted. You know, I mean, I did not want to have to go back home and tell my father that I failed. I had bad jobs. I walked off the line one night. I said, I'm not doing this. No. They put me in. What was this? I was climbing. It was a trunk job, a wire job. It was we were building 88s, 98s, Tornados, and Cutlasses at that time, and station wagons. And I had never, ever worked a production type thing. At that time, I think we were running about 68 jobs an hour. So approximately, what, every 48 seconds, you had a responsibility to that automobile. You would pick up your parts, you would go in, you would put them in, come back out, get another part, and you had to go to the next car. And if you got too far away, your hose wouldn't reach far enough, and you were down the line. And my timing wasn't there. You know what I mean? My timing wasn't there. I was down to the end, and people, the bosses were coming down wanting to know why I couldn't get that part on that car and get to the next one. And I couldn't do it. No, I couldn't do it right away. Well, I got frustrated at lunchtime one day, and I said, you know what, to my partner. His name was Jerry Van Elstein. He was also from the UP. He was from Drummond Island, Sault Ste. Marie. And somehow, some way, the two Upers got put together. And I just said, you know what? I'm not going to take this. People were hollering at me. I said, I can go home and have my father holler at me. And I walked out to the gate, and reality set in. I said, how am I going to go home and tell my dad that I just quit the job? So I turned back around. I made it through the guard shack. I turned back around, and I came back in, and I was late. I was down the line again. So here they are. They're back. They're all hollering at me, and I made it through that day. And I pretty much decided, you know, I got to do this. I got to know one of the supervisors. His name was Don Andrews, and they switched my job. I wasn't tall enough to reach in that trunk and get it up in there. I didn't have it. So they gave me that new job, that T-tops and sunroof job, and life was better.
You spoke prior to starting the interview. You talked a little bit about, I think it was that first job you were put on. There wasn't an assembly line, but there was a responsibility to feeding a conveyor. Can you tell that story? And what was it like?
At that time, we've commonized now. We're, in 2006, we have a limited number of colors, and basically you have one style of headliner. Back then, we had three different styles of headliners. There was a leather, there was a cloth, there was another type of fabric. And you'd have to put it into a machine, punch the hole in it to be able to put the headliner light up in it. Then you had to flip it over, run the wire up, tape it up. So you were preparing the headliner that ran up a conveyor belt, and they all had to be sequenced to the car that was going by up on the production line. Well, with 12 different colors, 12 different, or 16 different colors, fabric, then you had to put the sunshades also on to match, and sometimes there was different. Well, at that time, the people that were breaking me in, they said, well, you're doing pretty good. I started downstairs building up headliners. At that time, it was offline job, fed the production line. We had to sequence the headliners going up a conveyor belt to the cars up on the line. There was 16 different colors, three different cloths. You had to put the sunshades up on it. You had to punch a hole in it to identify which light's going to be on it. So you'd put the light, put the wire through the hole, tape it with duct tape on the back, and then you would send it up the conveyor with the sunshades on it. At that time, we had three people doing it, and those folks decided I was good enough that we could go 5 minutes on, 5 minutes off. So I'd build five, I would come, they would come back, then they would build five, and I'd get five jobs off. So I thought, this is a good thing. No, five on, five off, five on, five off. And they both left and left me there alone. Well, I got a little bit behind, and I pulled the wrong one. I got one out of sequence, so if one's wrong, from that one all the way down is wrong. Well, this gentleman comes up. He was very tall. He was skinny. and as you built that headliner, there was a manifest that had the options of the car that's going to reach the top. You had to initial it. This gentleman walks up, and he asked, "Who's Jay?" And I kind of raised my hand. I said, I'm Jay. My name's Jody. And he goes, "Come here, son." I said, "Your name, sir?" He says, "My name is John Powers." He said, "I'm the general supervisor here." And he said, "I want to know who did this." I said, "Well, I did it. I built these up." Well, it made the line have 5 or 7 wrong headliners. And this gentleman started screaming at me. He said, "Son, if you want to be on the outside looking in," he says, "I suggest you get up that conveyor, you get all these headliners back down." And he was screaming at these other folks that were breaking me in, and all of a sudden, boy, people were moving. Come to find out, this gentleman was very, very hard. He was cold. He was a car builder. People were scared of him. You didn't sit on stock. You didn't drop a screw. He was very, very, very scary. No, he was a scary guy. He was. People would see him coming, and they would be busy doing nothing. But they were busy. The rumor has it, you know, after so many years, this guy fired his own son. So it didn't matter to him. You were going to do as you were supposed to do on time and do it right, or you were fired. And the supervisors came down and kind of came to my defense, or I think I probably would have been fired at that time, because I put those wrong parts up on that conveyor belt. I built the wrong headliners.
And this was inside your 90 days?
Yes. This was in my first couple of weeks. Yeah. I thought I was done. I thought I was going to be fired. And that's when I asked. I said, "There's got to be another place." And I think we talked about that earlier. When they got me upstairs to the production line, I started doing T-tops and sunroofs. As my job. Much better job.
And you said they teamed you up with another gentleman from out of chance from the Upper Peninsula?
Yes, his name was Jerry Van Elstein. He was from Drummond Island, Sault Ste. Marie. His background, or his heritage, he was an Indian. And Escanaba, we do have a reservation in Hermansville. And he came from a reservation up in Sault Ste. Marie. So we kind of hit it off, and we ended up being partners. And we, like I said, I think we were working 6 days a week, 9 hours a day. But it was fun. It was fun to come to work. The camaraderie, the people, and we would eat and work overtime. Because at that time, that was a new process. So all the cars that we built in the morning, or, you know, in the afternoon, we worked from 5 until 3 in the morning, they would tell us, "You got to go down to offline water," and we would water test them to see if the cars leaked when we put the T-tops in them. Well, if they leaked, we'd have to take them all apart and put them all back together. And it was our job. We were the only ones that were trained to do it, so none of the repairmen knew how to do it. So we worked 10, 12, 14-hour days, 6 days a week. I think I got some Sundays in there, 7 days a week. I think we worked, what? I think my best was 38 or 39 days in a row without a day off. It was plentiful. Work was plentiful back then. Like I said, it was fun to come to work. I was a young adult. They had changed the drinking law. I had just turned 19, but then the law went to 21, so I was able to drink, and then I couldn't drink. And all the boys used to go buy me a beer for after work because I wasn't old enough, and they were teasing me that I wasn't old enough to drink. But I could work, I could vote, but I couldn't drink working in the factory. Having my own apartment, having my own vehicle, but we couldn't drink. But strange things happened at 3, 4, 5 o'clock in the morning.
Now, you said they picked on you. Going back to that, were there any new hire initiations or pranks that were played on you? And did you ever return those favors?
Oh, it was... I think my first one, when they sent me down to repair to get a bucket of steam. And I ran down there, and I was looking. And they were laughing at me. And then, because I was so excited, I wanted to do well. So, you know, they'd tell you, I was on the run. I was going for it. And I finally got down there, and I thought, a what? You know what I mean? A bucket of what? And then they would give me these off-name parts. There was no such part, but they'd sure send me for it. And I'd go down, I'd be asking everybody all the way up and down the line, and they're laughing at me as I'm going by, and I'd go back and getting lost, finding my way, and getting locked into the trunk was one of my initiation. They picked me up. Literally, there was two people. They picked me up. They put me in the trunk of what it had been? It would have been a 1978, 88. Put me in the trunk and shut it. And there's no locks in it at then. You got to have a screwdriver to stick through the hole to get yourself back out. And it was the joke. No, he's in the trunk. And we came down, and it was, oh, I gotta believe, I was in there 8, 10, 12 car lengths, or else they would throw you in there and send you into offline water, or water tests. Remember when we had water tests? They would take what they call the bezel light, and they'd loosen up the bezel light, put you in the trunk, so meaning the trunk would leak, okay? They'd lock you in, the water shooting in there at 80 PSI, pounds per square inch, and it would shoot in there. You'd be sopping wet by the time you got to the other end. They'd open up the trunk, and here comes a body. So it was quite a thing.
And as I said, did you get to return that favor?
Oh, well, there might have been a few instances where we had put a few people in the garbage cans and lock them into the trunk. It was good, clean fun. It was good, clean fun. We had fun. Nobody got hurt. But it was, I guess, the camaraderie.
You say that. You said it was so busy you couldn't afford to miss a car. You get a little bit down the line, it was hard to get back. So to throw you in a vehicle for 12 minutes, 12 car lengths.
Well, the joke was your repairman would always come down. You always had a person at the end of your area called the repairman. And, you know, they were all in cahoots. They kind of gave him a wave. Once I went in the truck, he came down. So he was doing my job until they let me out. It was intentional. They knew I was in there. So he would do 10 or 12 jobs for me while I was riding in the trunk down the line, and everybody said, "Hey, let me out!" Huh? And that was the trick. The one who put you in let you out. You did not open the trunk and get another person out, because if you did, guess who went in the trunk next? You know what I mean? So if someone was in there, you just kind of ignore them, let them go by.
So you've been sharing a typical day. Cars were running down the line. People were having a good time. Money was good. Hours were good. Did you consider your co-workers as brothers and sisters? Or did there come a day when that feeling...
You know the brother and sister thing, when I hired in, union was very, very strong. You did not violate anybody else's job. And I didn't understand that at the time. You know, I was young. I was 19 years old. And I didn't understand when I had people coming down screaming at me, "That is not your job. You don't do it." And today, 29 years later, I understand if you're doing somebody else's job, you're probably going to end up taking their job away. So if it was your specific job, that's what you did. And if you didn't complete your job, that was the repairman's job. You didn't just jump right in there and be doing somebody else's job from another area or something like that. That was the repairman's job, or it would go to the end of the line and it would be pulled off at the end, and they had what was called a repair hole. They would physically pull the car off and build it offline. But yes, I did. I did consider them my brothers and sisters. I think, as I said earlier in the interview, I wasn't used to having so many a diverse crowd around me. Okay, it was different. I had a lot to learn. I was most definitely wet behind the ears, naive, I guess the word would be. And it was a wonderful experience. I was proud to be a UAW person, working on my own, taking care of myself. I guess I did.
Have you developed friendships in the plant that extended outside of the plant?
One of my co-workers, and one of the first people I met, Teresa Gale, is now my wife. And that was, I met her, and I hired in September of 77, September, October. I probably met her at the end of October, and we have been recently married in the last 3 years. Doug, you and I have been together for quite some time. Cheryl and myself have been together quite some time. Most definitely, we've got most of our people from out of that plant. My good friends and confidants, come from the plant.
Well, you'd be surprised. A lot of the interviews we've done, some people never took a co-worker as a friend. Tell me, has a co-worker ever impacted your family life?
For instance, I'm not quite sure where you're going with that.
Some people, if you don't have anything, that's fine. We come back to it.
Well, you know, impact, absolutely they have. You know, I think that goes along with, you know, have we ever taken anybody in? Just about everybody that I've worked with has impacted my life in some way. One gentleman, his name is Joe Viglianco. We call him the Little Italian. He's just a little guy. But he built cars, classic cars on the outside, and that was always my interest to have a nice car. And he invited me to his house. And showed me some of his cars. He had a 68 and 69 Camaro Super Sport and a Rally Sport, and we became real good friends. A long story short, there is one of my first cars. I asked him to help me. I hired him to help me, and we wound up to be good friends to this day, going on 29 years. We are still in touch, but he helped me build an automobile, my first show car. And as we completed that car, a year and a half later, we took it to an auto show in South Bend, Indiana, and I came home with a first place trophy. So impact my life, yes, it was a huge impact. And he is one of a dozen people that have impacted my life. I've been very fortunate of moving around inside the plants and meeting many, many, many different people. So, yes, I got to leave.
I'm going to take you back in the plant. Oh, Cheryl McQuaid.
Jody, when you hired in 77, did you work around many minorities, women?
I think that was my point with a lot of diverse, different people. Where I was born and raised, there wasn't many minorities. We had American Indians up there, okay? But as far as blacks and Hispanics and women were just starting to really come into the body plan at that time. But I was like a little kid, because it was me, and the next hiring date was like the early 70s. So I was 19 years old, and it seemed like everybody around me was 30. So there was a 10 or 12 year hiring gap there. And oh yeah, there was just a wide variety of people.
Did you ever see any signs of discrimination?
Actually, it happened on a pretty much a routine basis. There was a lot. A lot of it was done in good humor, but you know, to today's standard of 2006, it was inappropriate. Some of the things that were done, some of the things that were said. Yes, there was.
Can you give me a for instance?
We had a gay individual working in there, and they picked on him. They picked on him very badly. We had a Mexican gentleman, Shaman Joe Rodriguez, another gentleman that impacted me highly. The reason he was called Shaman Joe is because if he could get out of work, oh my God, he'd do it. But they used to call him the pickle picker, okay? Or the dirty Mexican, and there was other things that I'd rather not go into, but there was. It was a way of life. I think I got caught up in it because everybody else did it. I just thought it was okay to do that. And to today's standards, it was inappropriate. You know what I mean? But yeah, it was there. It was most definitely there.
Also, what was a typical break or a typical lunch? What did you do for those times that you didn't have to work on the automobile?
Really?
Really?
You really want to know?
Where would you like to go with that?
well, there was a lot of card playing going on at that time. People were cooking in there. I hate to say it, there was a lot of drinking going on inside the plant. I didn't understand that at the time, but you can't do that. But if you'd get caught, it was automatic. You usually went out the door for a week if you got caught drinking in the plant. But it seemed everybody had a pretty good routine going, you know what I mean?
So a week wasn't that bad. There was still a lot of that in there, huh?
Realistically, there anything that you wanted, it was a city inside of a city, was in that plant. From gambling, to drugs, to prostitution, to alcohol, to whatever you wanted, gambling, they used to have gambling downstairs, there would be $1,000 on the table. They would take five material baskets high, and a fork truck would come, and it would back out, and all of a sudden, they're in there gambling, shooting craps or gambling downstairs in the parts areas. We had women that would cut hair at lunchtime. We had barbers. We had, you name it. You name it, it was in there. We had like a general store from alcohol to cigarettes to playing cards to pop and chips and you name it. It was in there. If you knew the right person. And one thing I learned right off the bat, you never, ever, ever told on somebody because they would come and get you. Literally, they would do physical harm to you if you would tell on somebody. I watched a gentleman as I walked out my first months get beat up out in the parking lot. So I started parking on the south parking lot, but then I realized I had to go all the way through paint and make my way down to the trim shop. It would take me, I'd have to come to work approximately an hour and a half early parking in the south parking lot because I got lost going from one end of the building to the other. So I went back to parking in the north parking lot. You know, you work at 9 and 10 hours a day and then you get there an hour and a half early, you know, made a long day. But, there was... Thanks.
You said that there was a lot of cooking going on. What kind of cooking, and did you get involved in any of the department dinners?
Oh, yes. We had a wonderful thing. I mean, they had frying pans and fryers, and they cooked fish and chicken and tacos, and people would bring in tamales and breakfast burritos in the morning. We had a guy that did like homemade cinnamon rolls, homemade cookies. They would bring them all in and sell them and share them and all that type of thing. So yeah, they did. They tons of food. Tons of food. Or you could order at Harry's across the street. They would give you a to-go pack, and they would run it right across the street, and they'd hand it through the gate, and you would pay them. Yeah, there was always something on.
Doug Rademacher. And there was a cafeteria, and there was always people that packed their lunch, but... there was lots of food, vending going on. You said
absolutely. Another example, old Daryl Mangles. He had ice cream. He had sandwiches. He had, he had a cooler in his arms most of the day. He was a relief man, and I think he had 4 or 5 coolers a day. Huge, large coolers that he would carry around and sell things. He was also the banker.
Banker.
Yeah, he would bring money in and cash your paycheck for $5, and he got to keep the change. He was also the banker. And there was other people that did it, too. Loan sharks. Sure.
So we've got up through the lunch. Tell us about... the typical day and these breaks. There was something called a wagon at one time that was unique to Fisher Body. Can you talk about what is that and what was it like to be working the line and waiting for that next break?
Well, at that time, we had what they called were relief people. They would go around and the line would never stop, okay? You could get more cars out the door if someone would come and relieve you to the present day where we shut the whole production line down and everybody takes a break at one time. We had relief men. So they would come to your job and they would do, 14, 15, 17. You'd get 2 breaks in the morning, 14-minute break, a 15-minute break, and after lunch you'd get a 17-minute break. And then if you worked over 8 hours, you got another 7-minute break. And you talked about wagon. What wagon was a little munchie cart. It had the chips and the coffee and all this stuff. And when the wagon would come by, was that? I don't remember. 7-8 minutes? The line would shut down and we could go get something off the cart. But they have eliminated that. I think, what, 1984? 1984, they eliminated that that wagon going around. I think they got, what, rolled in a wash-up or something like that.
What's a wash-up?
6 minutes prior to the line, they would give you a chance to go to the bathroom and wash up and get prepared to start your job or to end your job. 6 minute wash up time. And in turn, that has also went away. They bargained that away in the contract, the wash up times. So,
Cheryl had asked you about departmental dinners. Was there, what did you do in the holidays?
Oh, my first one, what a wonderful thing. And we talked about diversity. You know, coming from the UP, my father was a pretty much meat and potatoes guy, okay? I didn't know there was anything other than pepperoni on a pizza until I was 19 years old, okay? Because that's the way my dad liked it, so that's what we ate. Well, I come down here, you should see the food. Everybody in the whole department would bring, like, their specialty. If it was dessert or food or whatever the case may be, and we'd get a bunch of material boxes, and the fork trucks would bring them in, and we'd make a nice big long table and put a tablecloth on it, and everybody in that department, if you were involved, usually gave like $5 for the meat, and then you would bring something. What a wonderful thing. The wide variety of different tastes and how people prepare it, it was great. It really was. We looked forward to the holidays because normally the supervisor would kick in the meat, and, but if you got one of those not real bright supervisors out there, it would be, well, why don't you throw $5 in and then bring something to pass too? But normally the supervisor would buy the meat on the holidays and everybody else would bring something.
So you called it bright. Can you describe what you're saying here? What made a good boss? What made a bad boss?
You know, looking back on it, a good boss to me was straightforward. Okay, they wouldn't tell you any tales. They put it up front. They didn't lie to you. They didn't tell you one story and tell somebody else another story. And they always took care of their people. They didn't talk down to them. They didn't backstab you or talk about you. They cooked. They took care of your pay properly. And the biggest thing, they didn't scream at you. That was a good boss, because when I hired in, it was very intimidating. You know, there some of those supervisors out there were very, very intimidating. They would get up close and personal. They'd get right in your face and holler at you. You want to be on the outside looking in? I'm going to have your job. Get up the line. And it was a culture you had to definitely adapt to, and know who was teasing and who really meant business. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. Were you ever laid off?
Well, you know what? Looking back on this, with 29 years seniority as we talk today, or it will be 29 July 1st of 2006, what was the question again?
I asked if you'd ever been laid off.
Oh, yes. We looked at it as the best part-time job I ever had, because we had changeovers. Okay, so a changeover meaning that when the style of the car changed, they would have to go in and retool the line. So we would get that time off. And at that time, we would get in the upwards of 3 months off at a time. I was still employed with Fisher Body, but they would give me unemployment, what they called subpay. It supplemented my pay, so I got 80% of my pay not working. It was a wonderful thing. Best part-time job I ever had. But in a major, major layoff, I was very fortunate. With my background in training, I have had an opportunity to have a wide variety of people that have been to 4 and 5 and 6 different plants throughout General Motors, and basically we call them GM gypsies. But I started in 1977 at Fisher Body on Verlinden Avenue, and I have been there to the present day. I am a very fortunate person.
Okay, tell me about your first interaction with the union, and what did you think of the union, and what about you getting involved with the union?
Well, I can't remember. Well, actually, I do. It would be T-tops and sunroofs. See, T-tops and sunroofs was a new job, and there was no language in the contract what would reflect my job application. So when they wouldn't run cars or not run enough cars, they would say, I want you to go down there. Use me as a utility person, like a jack-of-all-trades person. You did wherever they wanted to send you, that's where they were going to send you. And I think I got involved as far as trying to get language into the contract. And I was young and dumb and loud and rude, and we had committee people like that were very loud. They would come out, and that's the way they would express themselves. If they were displeased about something, they would come out there in a rant, slamming their bag on the table, but I had some gentlemen that would come and kind of pull my leg. They were smooth talkers. And the favorite line was, you know what? After all the issues that we've just went through, all the documentation we've done, my hands are tied. And that really, really upset me at that time. Not enough for me to get involved. I started going to union meetings, and I realized there was a procedure that had to be followed at a union meeting. Well, I would start speaking, and I was speaking out of turn. And how I referred to it, I don't know if you remember the rollerblading thing, power jammers. I'd start talking, and they'd tell me, you're out of order. Well, we'd have another gentleman over here, he would say, I believe this should be tabled, and before you know it, they're asking me to leave the hall. So I didn't know procedure. I was talking out of turn. They were smarter than I was on the policies and procedures of what was going on in my surroundings. So it made me very frustrated. I kept going back. You know what I mean? They kept on asking me to leave. Then one individual impacted me. His name was Ronald Perry, Ron Perry. And he was a screaming old little guy. He was a short, fat little guy that just loved to talk, and he talked very loud. Well, him and I used to go round and round and round, and one day he put the challenge to me. He says, you know what? If you think you can do this better, get off your ass and get out there and get involved. And I said, maybe. You know what I mean? Maybe I will. Then we had a young lady that became my committee person. And it came down to a sport with me. I would go and investigate it. I would have the answers. I would call my committee person, and she wouldn't have it. Okay? So I'd have it all written down on a piece of paper. I'd take the piece of paper, and I'd slide it across the table. You know what I mean? I said, would this and this and this and this be the issue? And in that practice, I got to enjoy it. Okay? I guess I call it the hunt. All right? To go out there and investigate it, get the information, go represent it to management, and come back with a positive result. And unfortunately, at that time, there was too many people with that me, mine mentality. They were more interested in what was good for them, the selfishness. And I guess my favorite saying, if it's not good for we and us, it's not good. If it's not good for the whole group, you can't just be in there bargaining for one. You gotta impact everybody. And that's how I got involved. Because we had way too many of those me, mine mentality people in place. And I was a hothead. I was a loudmouth. My personal life, I guess they thought I was a little crazy at one time. But I ran for an alternate committee position. And my friends and people on the floor elected me. Because I was a little different. And I had the opportunity to serve as an alternate committee person for 2 terms as an alternate. One as a district, a manpower coordinator, a placement person. Throughout the years I've been here, I am now, to the present day, I'm a health and safety tech trainer at Building 66. We do 43 different classes, 4 different locals. On 3 different shifts, and there's 7 of us that service the Lansing area. That would be Local 602, Local 652, 1618, and 1753. So I got to believe I've been blessed to be able to go out there and serve my membership in a wide variety of unions. The different personalities and the different ways our union can work for the people, and sometimes it works just for a very few amount of people, and that's how I got involved, because I didn't like that very few people always getting the benefits of the union. And also something that I learned, if you don't get involved, you don't have a right to bitch. Okay? And you know what? I was good at that. So I had to get involved. I had to. I had to know what was going on, or they would beat you down. They'd crucify you. They would take you out. They would let you run. Make you look like a fool, you'd make yourself look like a fool, and then they would shut you down. And it happened to me several times. And that's when I decided, this is never going to happen to me again. I am going to find out how this program works. I am going to start coming to these meetings. I am going to follow these people. I'm going to pick their brain. I am going to get their knowledge. And they are not going to do that to me and other people again. And that's how I got involved. It was a matter of survival. They were trying to take my job away, feeding me a line, and I guess that's how I got involved. I don't know.
I'm going to take you back in the plant again, Jody. There's different areas in the plant. We know them as trim, paint, and body. Did you work in all three, and what was the environment like in those different areas?
When I started in 1977, I started in M trim, and realistically, it was still the old plant. I am so happy that I got to see the old way that we used to build cars. We used to have the A system and the B system that ran side by side. The big car line and the little car line. And everything was on the same floor. All the material was downstairs, and the both lines were upstairs. In 1978, they built a new paint department, the building 172. and they gutted the whole building, put the small car line downstairs, and they had the big car line was upstairs. So actually, we had two assembly plants in one. And people don't realize that our numbers reflected that. If I could jump ahead a little bit, our last heyday at Fisher Body, we built 485,000 cars in a 100-year-old facility. We trucked 7 cars at a time across town. We all built North American operations in every automotive company in the world out of a 100-year-old facility called Fisher Body. And we had the J.D. Powers Award in quality on both lines. And now, as we all know, we have a new Delta facility coming. So I got to believe what we did with a 100-year-old facility, almost 500,000 cars in a year, what can we do with a new plant? And that's why General Motors came here to Lansing. We build them on time, in budget, and we do it safely. It is the people. They could have went anywhere in the world, and they came here to Lansing, Michigan, because we have the best workforce. I've got to believe in one of the best regions, our union, on this end of the country. I've got to believe that. And that's after 29 years. And I know we were talking back, I jumped ahead there a little bit, but to my knowledge today and my experiences, nobody does it like Lansing. Nobody. They tell us the Japanese and the rest of them do it better than we do, but it's so close. It is so close now. We just got a bad rap from years ago.
Yeah, I guess that ought to.
Jody, I'm going to, again, take you back inside the plant. You're talking about the quality and the productivity of us has allowed us this new facility. But going back to the Fisher Body plant, working the assembly line, how did you pass the time away? Did radios or anything make the environment better to work in? What's the story about body, paint, trim, and just the differences?
Radios, when I first hired in, everybody had, a small radio. But then the times had changed. All of a sudden, I think they call them boom boxes now, these large radios that were as good as your sound system at home were in the plant. And yeah, it did make the day. I was working on the second shift, 5 to 3 in the morning, so that was the lower seniority folks were on the second shift normally. But there was some senior employees on the second shift, and sometimes there was some issues with radios. Some would be watching or listening to a baseball game, and then you had a young gentleman down there with rock and roll or something like that. Radio wars. It was something. Then management thought, well, we'll take care of that. They came through the plant and pulled every plug out. They said, you cannot use the power here in the body plant to play your radio. If you're going to play a radio, you're going to do it with batteries. And you know those big radios we have these days really sucked up the batteries. So it was expensive. I was one of the people that I had a little extra time on my job. I would climb up into the steel, and I would run extension cords from 2 blocks away, down and over, so we could have a radio and didn't have to pay for the batteries. I would crawl underneath ramps and run extension cords for our cooking, for our radios, for a TV. We'd had those little baby TVs in there for the ball games and things like that. Yeah, radios were really our friend. I mean, it passed the time. People don't realize there's no windows. You are working next to the same person most of the time. You spent more time with the people in the plant back then at 6 days a week, 9 hours a day, than you did with your family. And the wide variety of departments, the trim shop. I basically did most of my time in trim, but when I was involved with the union as a committee person, I represented areas 10 through 60, and I had quality control plant-wide. So I had an opportunity to go to the paint shop, into the body shop, and weld integrity. And the different ways people had to dress years ago in the late 70s and the early 80s, lead was still being used in our vehicles. And we know today lead causes health issues. They would be in full gear, like an air suit. They would put a helmet over your head with piped in air. So you want to talk about radios down in the body shop? It was very loud. They called it the jungle. All these weld guns and big sidewinders to screw bolts in the doors, the hinges, things like that. Then you'd go in the paint shop, and you'd have to have totally different coveralls. You always had to be very careful if you were going into the paint department. You had to be tested to make sure you didn't have the wrong deodorant or perfume or cologne or the wrong kind of soap because shampoo, because it would cause cratering into the paint. You would damage the product. So you just really couldn't be going from department to department if you didn't know. There was a lot of people that always walked in, went down the same aisle, went right to their job for 15 and 20 years. They didn't care about, if they worked in the body shop, they didn't care about paint and trim. They had no idea what was going on. It was like three different societies. Three totally different groups of people. The paint people, the body people, the trim people. Then it was the elite crowd, the repair people, the offline repair people, the water test people, just such a wide variety. I think we called it classifications back then. You had a classification on where you worked. You had to work inside your classifications. To present day, we've eliminated probably a good portion of all of those classifications. Basically, you're a worker now. But back then, you were a glass person, you were a paint person, you were a trim person, a body shop person, and then you had all the different facets of that department you could transfer around to.
Okay. Jody, there was a place, the plant has been there since the 20s, I believe. And there's a little establishment across the street. It's known as Harry's Place. You said that they brought lunch to you occasionally. Can you talk more about it? What is that place? What did it mean to the workers? And did you ever go there?
We talked earlier about your 90 days. Okay, I would not venture out. I would bring a lunch in. Sometimes, we would call across the street, and they would bring the lunch over. But for a good portion of the people, they started their day at Harry's. They would have a bite to eat. They would go there at lunchtime, have a bite to eat and possibly a spirit, and that's against the plant rules. You can't be drinking or anything like that on your job or be intoxicated. But it seemed the rules were bent a little bit, and a good portion of them ended their day at Harry's Bar or the other establishment right down the block, approximately a block away, a block and a half away, was the Irish Pub. So the Irish Pub and Harry's were kind of a staple for a lot of folks. They would start their day and end their day there or end their day there.
And did management go to these facilities?
As we started, there wasn't such a thing as management and union people being together. A couple of supervisors would sneak down with us, but their upper management did not want the folks, the UAW folks and the salaried folks playing together, I guess you would say, socializing together. They try to keep us as two different groups. Unlike today, we have an open relationship with management. Well, back then, we did not. We did not have that open relationship, and they tried to keep us apart. They really did.
Okay. The plant has been there forever. It's changed names and numbers of time. What is the plant? When it closed, what was it called, and what is it to you?
Lansing Car Assembly. When we closed, I think we were BOC, Buick, Oldsmobile, Cadillac Group. We were Fisher Body. But I got to believe it will always be Body by Fisher, Fisher Body to me. Okay? Lansing Car Assembly, BOC, Buick Oldsmobile, Cadillac Group. You know, a lot of that to me was all they would reorganize just to take money out of my pocket as far as my profit sharing and things like that. You know, in the past, some of our managers, and this is North American operations and our Lansing site, made some very bad decisions for us that impacted the town, the quality of the vehicles, but I gotta believe, overall, capital of quality. When I hired in, there was pride. We had banners up and down the hallways going into the cafeteria, every stairwell, every aisle, everything was swept, cleaned. People were proud. People were proud on what they built. Our society on the outside, on the other hand, kind of believed that we were overpaid, lazy people in their building cars, but they were wrong. They are wrong. If they could walk a mile in my shoes, and some of the operations, I've had great jobs, I've had some nasty jobs in that place, but General Motors and Fisher Body Lansing has been good to me. They owe me nothing. They've given me a paycheck since I've been 19 years old. And again, I've to this present day, it'd be 28 and a half years. It's been a great place to work. They've given me loads of opportunity as far as training and committee work and people and product. And it's a wonderful place. And my hope is that things are going to pick up and possibly our children will get younger people back in there and we'll build cars again like we used to. Millions and millions and millions of Oldsmobiles that we built in Buicks and Chevrolets. And, you know, people don't realize we built 11 different car lines. We kept other plants across town busy when we did the Cavalier, the Malibu. We did convertibles, two doors, four doors. That body shop produced over 13 different body styles, completely different automobiles we built out of that facility. It's been a good thing for me.
You're there. I want to know, what's one of your best memories of Fisher Body? Do you have a moment that stands out in your mind?
Well, I guess one of a good moment for me is when I did get involved and the light finally came on that when I was elected for the first time. Because I've had a wide variety of, you know, safety coordinator, EPG coordinator, cost coordinator, and all these different things. And then when I finally made the commitment to go out there, and I didn't do it alone. I had folks behind me. When I was elected in 1992 for the first time, I got to walk my folks out on our first strike. You know, it was my first strike. And as an alternate committee person, I walked my department out onto the picket line. I think that's probably something that's very memorable to me. I've had some horrible things happen. I watched a conveyor up in the paint department break. It fell down on a woman's head. It drug her down the line because safety equipment wasn't there. They didn't have safety chains on the carriers. We fired up that paint department way too soon. It was not ready for production, and we did it anyway. But we learned. We learned from that. Did not kill her. She was injured, but that was a scary thing for me. But good memories. I don't think we have enough tape here to go through some of the wonderful memories of the body plant. Personal mistakes. Made a few. Made some bad choices in my life. Financially, physically, relationships. But all in all, that place does not owe me anything. They give me a paycheck every week. I've had an opportunity of meeting people. My wife, we are still there. I'm blessed. I work. I take care of my family. I try to be active with the union. It is the right thing to do. Union people are good people. Unlike our society believes, we're overpaid and things like that. But if we look back in history, that would be another interview. If it wasn't for the union people, we wouldn't be where we are at today. So yeah, I've got many, 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 many wonderful experiences there.
You have are active. You said you try to stay active. You're on the union label committee. You volunteer under your appointed position to safety. There's some obligations.
Well, we've been directed from our leadership that they would like to see us involved in the community, which is right. Approximately, at a bare minimum, 12, 16, 18 hours a year. We should get out and give back to our community and our brothers and sisters. Our membership. Because realistically, these elected and appointed jobs, what are we here for? It was our choice to serve the membership. And unfortunately, sometimes people forget where they came from. And these things go to the wayside. So I think that part is just to kind of keep us on track. Okay? I got to believe I do well over and above my mandatory time that's allotted. But it's my choice. It's my choice to do that. And I got to believe it's the right thing to do. Does it conflict with my family sometime? My downtime? Yes, it does. But, it's the right thing to do.
I'm going to move over to benefits, Jody. What's your most appreciated bargain benefit?
I got to believe present day. It would be my benefits as far as health care and things like that. My glasses, my dentist, way back when, when I hired in, I guess it would be vacation time. My total package, everything that's bargained for me in my contract. Because would management just give it to me? I can't believe so. I can't believe they would just hand it to me. So everything that we've got, from my vacation to my health care benefits, it's all good.
Skilled trades is important to keep the plant running. What was your relationship with them, and did you ever have them do anything special for you?
Our skilled trades personnel, people don't realize We were the world headquarters for Oldsmobile for over 100 years. We had more talent in this town as far as from engineering to design to our skill trades, tool makers, jig and fixture, the fuels labs, and we have really, really narrowed that down. It's gone away. Do something special. You know, as a committee person, I would go, there's a policy and procedure to adhere to when it comes to getting work done in the plant as far as work orders and things like that. But I had friends that were skilled tradespeople and people I was involved with as a committee person that we would ask for something done. And, you know, I can't say too many people denied me. If it was in their power, I would say 9 out of 10 times they would come out and do that. Unfortunately, we have a lot of folks that go out there and do other people's jobs. I think we touched upon this a little bit earlier. But people don't realize our brothers and sisters in the trades are being eliminated on a daily basis. If it is not your job, you should not do it. Unfortunately, I think I've violated my own, you know, my own rule there sometime to do that. But and that goes for our production, our material, our sanitation folks. Our times are changing. They're this lean manufacturing. Work harder, work smarter, not harder. We've eliminated a lot of folks. That would be the early 80s. We had 6,200 people at Local 602. Across town at 652, I think we were about 12,500 people. Our present day, what's our scale? About 3,100, roughly?
We're not that big.
I think that's what we left with. Then we 2,800. 2,600. So from the time when I'd have to line up in front of Harry's, we had cars lined up all the way to the parking lot with, you know, 6,700 people down to half. And we built more cars than we did back then. But our trades folks, they kind of fell into the category. They've kind of worked themselves out of a job. But it's not right. That's our skilled labor, our high-paying jobs, and hopefully that would be each and every one of us' goal is to work ourselves into something like that. It's not cut out for everybody, but trades, you know, it's a great thing.
Well, we're about at the end of this interview. I want to ask you what it feels like to see the plant being torn down at this time, and if you have something that you feel we haven't asked, add that at this time.
Well, to tell you the truth, I'm sitting in the greenhouse in this interview, and we were just outside looking at the old entrance to paint, which is no longer there. Honest to God, I never thought I would see the day. I never thought I would see the day that the capital of quality, Fisher Body, would be taken away. It's a changing time in our society. Our sister local, 652, has been impacted also. It's just sad to see some of this history go. Fortunate for us, we do have a new facility, Delta, and we discussed that as far as we do have the best workforce around. That's why we do have a new facility. But I don't know. It's sad. It's sad to me to see the old girl go away, because there's so many memories. The beautiful cars that we've produced, the millions and millions we've produced. Were they all good? No. You know, we had some dogs in there. The the old station wagon, you know what I mean? We were in that boxy time of our design. You know, we had some dogs in there, but...
You didn't design it.
Yeah, we didn't design it. The old 87-style Cutlass Salon, the little slanted no-trunk vehicle, our poor little Achieva, there was some cars out there that weren't good, but you know what? We put them together proper. And all in all, I would like to thank Jerry and John, Cheryl, Doug, for giving me this opportunity to share my time. I gotta believe I am a car builder. I am not building cars at this present time. My leadership has given me the opportunity to be a health and safety tech trainer and to continue to serve my membership. But I gotta believe I am a car builder. This has been... I don't know what I would have done in my life other than build cars. I was young. I've basically done nothing else in my life. My hobbies of working on automobiles and my home and my yard and things like that and camping. But I don't know. What I would have done. I work next to people that have multiple degrees. I'm basically uneducated, and this place has been a great place to work. It's not over. I've still got a young man, my son Jacob. He's 13 years old, so Dad's going to have to work just a little bit more. I'm anticipating about 35 or 36 years, so that would be another 5 or 6 years for me. Hopefully we're going to be successful bringing our new car line in with our new plant. And thanks again, folks, for the opportunity.
It's been a pleasure, Jody. Thanks for taking
Thank
the time
you.
To
Thank
share
you,
your story.
Thank you, Jody.